The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm so pleased to see so many of you here on this very cold night. In one of the epigraphs to his new book, What It Is, Race, Family, and One Thinking Black Man's Blues, Clifford Thompson quotes from the essay collection, Nobody Knows My Name. But I still believe that the unexamined life is not worth living. And I know that self-delusion in the service of no matter what smart or lofty cause is a prize no writer can afford. His subject is himself and the world, and it requires every ounce of stamina he can summon to look on himself and the world as they are. It's an apt quotation from an essay by James Baldwin, because both of our guests this evening possess the stamina and vision to see the world and themselves as they are, and somehow get that down in clear and bracing prose. Clifford Thompson is the recipient of a Whiting Writers Award, and his work has appeared in a diverse array of publications, including The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of a previous essay collection, Love for Sale, as well as a novel, Signifying Nothing. And he teaches writing at New York University and Sarah Lawrence College. Thompson's latest book ruminates on race amidst the tumult of Trump's America. Kirkus Reviews calls the essays graceful and searching. Saeed Jones is the author of the poetry collection Prelude to Bruise, winner of the 2015 Stonewall Book Award, Barbara Gittings Literature Award. He was, until recently, the co-host of BuzzFeed Morning Show AM to DM, and was the website's former LGBT editor. His new book, How We Fight for Our Lives, winner of the 2019 Kirkus Award for Nonfiction, is a memoir of Jones' life as a young black gay man in the South searching for his place in the American landscape. And as our friend Jacqueline Woodson has written, every single living half-grown and grown-up body needs to read this book. Please welcome our first presenter, Saeed Jones.
Hello. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to hear Clifford read his work and celebrate his new book that just came out, which is wonderful, and for the conversation. And it's good to be here. I have had so many wonderful experiences in Philadelphia. Hi. And so I've so been looking forward to coming back and to share this book with you. I think in the spirit of that enthusiasm, I'm going to do something I have not done on the entire book tour. I'm going to read new poems tonight. I'm excited to share them with you. They're new, you know, so, you know, be even nicer than usual. The book too is still a thing. I haven't forgotten. So I'm going to read the poem that opens the book, which is about my mom. And then I'll read a short excerpt from one of the chapters, and then we'll get to poems. Okay? Okay, wait, some coffee. Jet lagged. Oh. They don't tell you how far away the West Coast is from the East Coast, but I gotta tell ya, far. Okay, so this is the prelude that opens the memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives, and the title is Elegy with Grown Folks Music. I wanna be your lover comes on the kitchen radio, and briefly, your mother isn't your mother. Just like if the falsetto is just right, a black man in black lace panties isn't a faggot, but a prince, a prodigy. And the woman with your hometown between her hips shimmies past the eviction notice burning on the counter, and her body moves like she never even birthed you. The voice on the radio pleads, I want to be the only one that makes you come running. Some songs take women places men cannot follow. Spinning, she looks at but doesn't see you. Spinning, she sings lyrics too fast for you to pursue. Spinning, she doesn't have time for questions like, what is this nasty song? And where did she learn to dance like that, and why, and who is this high-pitched bitch of a man who can sing like a woman and turn your mother not into your mother but a woman? Not even a woman, but a box-braided black girl, a fast girl, a chick, a vanity six, and how far away she is from you, right here in the same living room, dancing with the song's hook in her throat. And you hate the voice coming through the radio because another sissy has snatched your dreams and run off with them. And because you are young and don't know the difference between abandoned and alone. Just like your mother's heart won't know the difference between beat and attack. She will be dead in a decade. And maybe you already know what you are losing without knowing how. But you're just a boy for now. And your mother is just a woman, just a girl. Body swaying, fingers snapping, and snakes in her blood. Thank you. So the part of the book, so How We Fight for Our Lives is about me. and it is, coming-of-age memoir. I grew up in Lewisville, Texas. I'm home of the Lewisville High School Fighting Farmers, just north of Dallas, to give you some sense of context. Our mascot was Farmer John. You know, at that time, watching Matthew Shepard and his death be reported on in the news, and watching James Burke Jr., a black man who was killed by white supremacists in 1998 when I was 12, 4 hours from where we lived in Lewisville, you know, seeing all of that, really, as it does for all young people, right, what's happening in America impacts how we begin to understand the identities we are becoming more aware of. For me, that meant being black and gay. And so this excerpt I'm going to read is from part 3 of the book. I'm a college student at this point. A lot of my feelings about shame and my anger about the shame that I feel that I'm being forced to deal with because of America have metastasized. And though my mom doesn't appear in this chapter, I just want to say that what you kind of see is when we become strangers to our loved ones, we are estranged from the wisdom and the love, right, that they can afford us. And this happens so often for queer people, right, where we are left to figure so much out on our own, right? You just got to figure it out, right? And we're denied that wisdom. And so by the time I was a senior in college, I was really struggling, and you'll see that. So even though she's not in the chapter, she is, if that makes sense. And what else do you need to know? Oh, I had dreadlocks in college, and that comes up at one point. Did I mention I'm gay? That's helpful. That's helpful context too. You know, give you all the tools you need. Okay. Chapter 15, December 31st, 2007, Phoenix, Arizona. A joke I used to repeat in those days was, why be happy when you can be interesting? I knew how to be interesting. There was power in being a spectacle, even a dark spectacle. The punch and the line. Interesting. Sentences like serrated blades, laughter like machine gun rounds, a drink in one hand, a borrowed cigarette in the other. If you could draw enough glances, any room could orbit around you. That New Year's Eve, I wound up at a party that was exactly like every college party I had ever been to. An iPod hooked up to a pair of speakers, an awkward costume theme I tried and failed to adhere to, and an apartment clogged with white people. The only difference was that I was getting wasted in Phoenix, Arizona, instead of Bowling Green, Kentucky, where I went to school. In the few days I'd been there, I had concluded that Arizona was perhaps the whitest place I had ever visited. It was like stepping onto the surface of a very well-lit moon. The party's theme was the future, which is why more than half the people in attendance were wearing some combination of synthetic fabric, aluminum foil, and sunglasses. I hadn't known that there would be a theme, and the only other shirt I had packed was a blue calico button-down. So I put my dreadlocks into two pigtails and kept telling everyone I was Dorothy. No one found this in any way strange because, of course, this was the future. And all bets are off in the year 2075. In the first few hours of the party, Either I didn't notice him, or the man who would later try to kill me simply hadn't arrived yet. All night, I was a terrific, bright black mess. I stomped, slinked, sauntered in and out of the kitchen to refill my cup or do shots. I shouted orders about the songs that should be added to the party's playlist. Out on the porch, smoking cigarettes, then passing around a blunt, I stared at an orange tree just out of reach until I finally plucked off a fruit. It seemed miraculous. Oranges in the dead of winter. Then I realized the unseen side of the fruit was rotted, ants pouring out of the ruin like ink. Looking back, I can see how someone might see me that night and argue that I had it coming, that I had a man like him coming. If that someone was America herself, I can understand how she might rattle off a warning. That black boy has been too hungry for too long. One of these nights, he's going to bite off more than he can chew. I will say for myself, America, I did the best I could with what I was given. The man, let's call him Daniel, looked familiar when I saw him from across the room, as if each part of him had been borrowed from some other boy or man I had wanted. Leaning against that wall, dispassionately sipping a beer, he was the kind of quiet I have noticed in certain men and long hungered for. The silence of men who have it all, and thus find it all boring, who don't exert the energy necessary to flirt, persuade, or convince because they know America will come crawling to them on hands and knees. I realize now that what I wanted was not just the bodies of such men, but their power, and what they could use that power to do to the rest of us. The brutal exertion of will, destiny made manifest by the unspoken threat their muscled bodies and white skin posed. I hungered for the power of the all-American man. The Marlboro man and the Marlboro man's firstborn son, the high school quarterback, the company's future CEO, Ernest Hemingway, John Wayne, Odysseus, Hercules, Achilles, the shield itself, the stone-cut archetype, the goddamned everyman, the golden boy, the one. If I could not actually be the one myself, I thought I could survive by devouring him whole. The more straight, the more masculine, the more I wanted to see him with his legs spread or up, back arched in an orgasm that did not just bring him pleasure, but a warning. In spite of the man you say you are, in the future I live in, men like me are coming to conquer you, and we will take no prisoners. This is what I thought it meant to be a man fighting for his life. If America was going to hate me for being black and gay, then I might as well make a weapon out of myself. Thank you. Okay. I have a suspicion. I'm going to make an assumption about writers. I think every writer, as soon as you finish a book you've worked on so hard, you're like, okay, so I'm never going to write about that stuff again. And here's some new poems where I'm writing about all that stuff again. So I'm going to read three poems, and then I'm going to sit down and enjoy my latte and, you know, learn. So I've been writing a series of poems about grief, and this is one of them. I wrote it on Friday the 13th under a Scorpio moon, if you want that for context. Grief number 913. I grieve the boy I killed and the country fashioned out of his bloodstains. I grieve that it was so easy, the knife lazy and confident invading him. This is what love feels like. I grieve that he believed me. Dumb animal, doe-eyed, ready-made gift, just another border outlined in barbed wire and crime scene chalk. I grieve that even then, I already knew I'd do it again, 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 again. I grieve a continent, nations united by the way terror turns me on. The hot instant between thrust and gasp. I want you, and I had you. Again, 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 again. I grieve my face onto the covers of history books. I grieve the descendants, dumb animals, dead-eyed, ready-made gifts. This is what love requires. I grieve that they still believe me. So a few weeks ago, I've done, this is nearing the end of my book tour, which is why I'm going crazy and reading poems for the first time in forever. And because K.S.A. Lehman was a wonderful writer and his book Heavy is such a generous offering, I think of it as a sibling of my book, I wanted to spend time with him, and I did. Woo, oh, Mississippi's Heavy. Is an intense place. And I was in Oxford, Mississippi, where Ole Miss is, for several days. So I'm just going to read one last poem, and this is about my time there earlier this fall. The title comes from the last line in Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. Spoiler, they kill somebody. Someone got mad at me on Twitter. I was like, it's like the most famous show. It's published in the 50s. Okay. It isn't fair. It isn't right. The color of a memory is the difference between haunted and hunted. In Mississippi, red, white, and blue don't mean, remember, this is America. They mean history is a gun, and every bullet in its chamber wants you to forget. They mean we tried our best not to be America and failed, and now we keep forgetting to forget. And anyway, who did you vote for? No need to ask us. You already know. They mean the white man in the White House tweeted this morning that he's being lynched. Outside my hotel, no, I'm not from around here. On the street corner, there is a plaque that tells me where I can find the body of the town's first white settler. But it's almost sundown, and I've been told darkness in Mississippi is not a metaphor, so I chase the shadow back into the hotel. At the bar, I beg the bartender to make me a stronger drink. He tries, and he fails. I'm scared and black and mostly sober at the hotel bar and reading an essay about lynching when some Ole Miss frat boys explode into the room, cheering in a dead language, and my heart doesn't even wait for me to get the check. My heart is already gone. My heart is cowering in the hallway in front of my hotel room because I have the key and I just now got the check, and I keep forgetting to forget that the America I was born in will not be the America in which I die. Thank you.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Free Library for hosting this event. I'm very excited to be here. So let's see here. I'm going to read, my new book, which is being published today, is five, thank you. There are five chapters and an introduction, and what I thought I would do is read the introduction to you. It's fairly self-explanatory. People ask me what the book is about, and I say, well, it's kind of a memoir, and it's essentially a response, a personal response to the election of our current president. And I think that's probably all you need to know. I did want to add that Philadelphia, I got to put these on because I'm an old dude at this point. Philadelphia has a special place in my heart because when I was way back in the 1970s, I have two older sisters. I grew up in D.C. We all grew up in D.C. And I have two older sisters, and one of my sisters went to Temple University here, and my other sister would come to visit her, when, and she would she would kind of drag me along. Not drag me, I wanted to come. But you know, I'd be there in my wide eyes and, you know, with my G.I. Joes and, you know. So it's nice to come here. Okay, so I'm going to have a sip of water and then read the introduction. Okay, let's see what we got here. I am a black man, Brooklyn-based, 54 years old as I write this. For nearly as long as I can remember, there has been, at the core of my being, making me who I am, or who I feel that I am, the belief that I must treat everyone as an individual, that I must not base my judgments on anything as inconsequential as skin color. And for most of my adult life, I have chosen to see myself as an American, because of the contributions black people have made to this country, because of how inextricably this country is tied to my heritage, and despite white racist belief that this country is theirs more than it is mine. Living according to these principles has sometimes been tough. In my late teens and 20s, moving from the all-black environment where I grew up to integrated circles in college and beyond, I sometimes felt like the only black person I knew who was not reluctant because of distrust, dislike, or both, to be in the predominantly white settings where my interests often took me. I clung stubbornly to my beliefs, and in my mid-20s I found what I considered to be support for my point of view when I picked up, somewhat belatedly, the books of James Baldwin. Leaving aside for a moment the music of Baldwin's sentences, the grandness of his vision, the wisdom and lyricism he brings to expressing the anger and ache of being black in America, he was the first model I found of one who brought everything he had to bear on opposing racism without being racist himself. His fiction, particularly the underappreciated Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, and his nonfiction, none more eloquent than The Fire Next Time, are the work of a man who rages at injustice but loves deeply and without regard to pigmentation. While the assassinations of Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr., along with the other aspects of the backlash against the civil rights movement, left Baldwin embittered and disillusioned, they did not ultimately compromise his humanity or make him into a racist. He remained, for me, a model of how to conduct oneself with regard to race. And yet, I still felt some confusion. There was one substantive difference between me and the white people in my circle. Being white, I discovered, seemed to make one exempt from the question of who one is. They were Americans, these white people, and it never seemed to occur to them, and certainly no one ever indicated to them, that they should think otherwise. Many black people, of course, are exempt from this question of who they are, too, by virtue of living and working largely or wholly among other blacks. But if a person's life and interests take him, as mine have taken me, to places where he looks different from most others, that person may begin to ask where the similarities between himself and these others end, and the differences beyond the obvious one begin. What the basis for these similarities is, and what the basis for the differences is, and into which camp, similarity or difference, nationality falls. And with regard to the very question of whether nationality constitutes a bond or barrier between oneself and others, the basis of this question is an unspoken assumption that runs so deep, that is reinforced so often and in so many ways, that I passed 3 decades of life on Earth before I questioned it. The assumption? That being American means being white. At best, the place of blacks in all this seemed to be the one described by the comedian Chris Rock, who said that for us, America is like the uncle who molested you and then paid for your college education. I wish that was my line. As much as I would like to say that I began to question that assumption on my own, I had help. It was the work of the essayist Stanley Crouch, which in turn led me to the work of his mentor and soon to be mine, Albert Murray, that opened my eyes. Murray's books, beginning with the Omni-Americans, proposed an alternate view that America, rather than simply being a white monster that feeds on people of color and that only the most self-hating of dark-skinned folks would identify with, is in fact largely a black creation, in terms of everything from culture to physical labor, and that the blood, sweat, and investment of generations of blacks makes America our home as much as that is anyone's. According to this view, the struggles blacks have historically faced have provided the obstacles over which we demonstrated the ability to triumph. As Murray wrote in The Omni-Americans, quote, "The legendary exploits of white U.S. backwoodsmen, keelboatmen, and prairie schoonermen become relatively safe when one sets them beside the breathtaking escapes of the fugitive slaves the fugitive slave beating his way south to Florida, west to the Indians, and north to faraway Canada, through swamp and town alike, seeking freedom. Nobody was chasing Daniel Boone, end quote. To say I am an American, then, is not an act of capitulation, but the first step toward claiming one's birthright, recognizing the setting of one's ancestors' triumphs and adventures. It is tantamount to saying, I am home. The symbol for this idea, the art form that allows me to celebrate this notion of laying claim to a home, birthright, and identity, is jazz. The basis of jazz, a black contribution to American and world culture, is improvisation, a metaphor for the story of black Americans who have historically had to make a way where none existed before, a way that brought about both the Underground Railroad and the Civil Rights Movement. Every time a jazz musician improvises a passage, he or she celebrates this history. I embrace the sound and what it stood for, the fleet-footed sweetness of the alto saxophonist Julian Cannonball Adderley, the crusty vulnerability of Ben Webster's tenor sax, the spare melancholy of Miles Davis's trumpet, the sheer might of the original tenor man Coleman Hawkins, the beautiful eccentricity of Thelonious Monk's piano, the deceptive laziness of Billie Holiday's voice, the doggedness and inventiveness of the young Freddie Hubbard as he played trumpet lines over and through the thundering drum beats of Art Blakey, the doggedness and inventiveness necessary for survival for any jazz musician, any black person, anyone at all. And so, in my early 30s, a youngish man and new father to a biracial child, a budding essayist who earned his living as an editor and copy editor, a seeker after cultural knowledge, with Murray in my head and Baldwin in my heart, I set out into the big bad world, reading book after book while strap hanging on my way to and from work, listening at night to those jazz records that were the record of my people's contribution, believing all the while in the rightness of calling myself an American as years and then two decades passed. Along the way, the first black president was elected, which appeared to confirm what I had already decided. Along the way, events may have chipped at the outside of my beliefs, killings of blacks from Trayvon Martin on through Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, and so many others may have led me to question whether I really wanted to call home a place where the police were seemingly paid to kill people who looked like me. And yet, neither Baldwin nor Murray had ever said that I wouldn't have to fight to protect my place in this land I called home. With many others, I took to the streets over those killings and believed I was doing so in service of my country. Perhaps some, black and white, wondered how I could be so even-keeled, and perhaps some, white as well as black, wanted me to be angrier. Some whites in particular appeared to think I should act through my anger as their conscience. The problem with that was that I already had a job. I did not have time to be anyone's conscience. And there is a word for one who does others' work for no pay, and I'm not thinking of intern. And so my beliefs at bottom held steady. And then came the election of Donald Trump. For a black man who has based his life on a belief in treating everyone as an individual and on an identification with America, what is the right response to a successful presidential campaign that brought out xenophobia like lava from a volcano? How do I respond to the fact that the majority of white voters whom I have refused to hate as a group supported this man? Should I hold on even tighter to the notion of being an American and fight to protect myself and my country from this menace? Or should I distance myself from a country where so many people seem to have demonstrated that they care nothing about me? Is it time to resign my post as the only non-racist black person in America? Or is now, when my principles are sorely tested, the most crucial time to hold on to them? I had arrived at my beliefs with the help of Baldwin and Murray. But I began to sense during this crisis that I needed still another writer, not to give me answers, but to serve as a model for how I might find them on my own. This writer puts me in mind, if this comparison is not too odd, of 1970s TV detectives, the kind with distinguishing characteristics, only instead of being old like Barnaby Jones, or overweight like Cannon, or paraplegic like Ironside, or blind like Longstreet, or rumpled like Columbo, this writer-detective has characteristics you can't see at a glance, and her show, if she had one, would be highly unusual indeed. This writer-detective is a woman, yes, but her distinctiveness doesn't even begin there. She is glamorous, wearing dark glasses and dark shoulder-length hair, holding a cigarette in long, elegant fingers, but her thinness and vague era of uncertainty and sadness also make her seem frail. All of that is odd enough in a detective, but it would be during the show's climax that we would see what truly makes her special. This is the part of every program where the detective reveals what really happened, who did the deed and why. As our detective begins to explain, we are struck by the length of her sentences. We think they're about to end, then realize they're just getting started. cohering perfectly for all their complexity and gathering force as they go. They have great power, these sentences, the force and sweep of a flood, but just as a flood is an awesome force carrying along all manner of small objects, these sentences, for all of their epic proportions, are full of telling details. And yet, even this isn't the astounding part. More startling than the power of our detective's phrasing is what she actually says, which is the opposite of what TV detectives usually say. The mystery, she tells us, gazing straight into the camera, will remain a mystery, because despite all she has learned about it, which is more than most would have uncovered, there are some things that no one knows or ever can know, secrets that are few are privy to, but most of us never will be. Are you confused by what you've seen and heard, feeling somehow that it lacks logic or a point? Then, says the detective, you and I together have arrived at the same truth. Who is this writer, this undetective, this well-informed, tragic figure telling us that the more we learn, the less we know? She is Joan Didion. It was because of my own writing that I began to investigate Didion's work. In the 1990s, around the time I started a family, I also began to write essays, many of them published in the Threepenny Review, that discuss books, jazz, film, and painting in relation to my own life, essays that mix the personal with the critical, which I didn't see anyone else doing quite the same way. Here, it seemed, was the purpose of all my obsessive reading, all my late-night sessions of listening to classic jazz after putting the girls to bed, all my mad scribbling of previously unknown film titles, book titles, album titles in my ever-present pocket notebook. Writing about jazz in particular became a way of writing about life's challenges. And a few years later, those pieces, along with personal essays and pieces on books and film, race and identity, made their way into my first book. But how much is truly original? Whatever innovation I may have brought to the form, I knew I wasn't the first writer to inject personal elements into criticism and journalism, or vice versa. And so, wanting to explore what my forebears had done, I began a serious reading of the so-called new journalists with whose work I was casually acquainted. I checked out books by Gay Talese and Hunter S. Thompson. I read quite a bit of Norman Mailer's nonfiction and everything written up to that time by Tom Wolfe. But as much as I enjoyed Wolfe's similes and smart acidness, Talese's calm eloquence, Thompson's wackiness, and Mailer's sheer ego, there was one writer among this crowd whose work for me surpassed the rest. More than any of the others, Joan Didion's essays gave me the sense, for all that some call her inscrutable, of revealing the person behind them, of letting the reader in, as suggested by her oft-repeated phrase, "I want to tell you about..." And once, in assessing the character of the artist Georgia O'Keeffe, she might have been talking instead about herself, quote, "a woman clean of received wisdom and open to what she sees." Didion's work appealed to me for other reasons, too. Her sadness, her flirtations with a sense of meaninglessness spoke to something in me. I had, I suppose, reached what the novelist Jane Smiley calls the age of grief, one that perhaps every parent, deep in his or her heart, comes to eventually. In 2006, my wife, my daughters, and I vacationed at a lake house in Maine with two other couples and their young children. The setting was gorgeous, the water clear, the air pleasantly crisp and filled with our kids' joyous shouts. Here was the kind of atmosphere that ought to have inspired me, even if it inspired only my contented sighs, but also the kind that can sometimes point up, by contrast, what is wrong. "Usually such beautiful landscapes fill me with a sense of possibility," I wrote in my journal during that vacation in an entry dated August 25th, 2006. I went on to note, quote, "my old sadness, sense of pointlessness, especially as regards the kids, sadness for them, a feeling of futility for them," unquote. Watching my girls running around outside and having fun with the other kids, which should have made me happy, only gave me the feeling that in the end, their earnest, heartbreaking efforts to do, learn, and grow would pass into oblivion, along with their childhoods, would amount to what, in a big world that wouldn't love my children the way I did. In the journal entry written more than a decade ago now, I can feel my efforts to comfort myself as when I wrote, quote, "the past isn't past. The good memories of childhood, just like the bad ones, are with you always. Nothing is futile in life or art," end quote. I needed to hold on to something clearly. The first sentence of Didion's essay, The White Album, comes to mind. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. I was trying to allay my worries, but I wonder now if the true cause of those worries about my daughters was that they were being raised and protected in this mean, mean world by me? Surely those wonderful girls deserve someone smarter, stronger, more capable? The happier my children seemed, the sadder their plight appeared to me, those poor kids blind to the shakiness of their lives' foundations. Somehow, and so far, those girls, now young women, have survived despite having a father who managed to pass the age of 50 without getting it through his skull what his country really thinks of him. or is now, when my principles are sorely tested, the most crucial time to hold on to them? Or is this very question a desperate attempt to evade the ugly truth? Is it worse as twilight approaches to be a fool or to turn my back on what makes me who I am? In this dark hour, it is the quality of Didion's that she observed in Georgia O'Keeffe, being clean of received wisdom and open to what she sees, that I most need to take on as my own. Given recent events, given daily affirmation that the country I've chosen to identify with has chosen a racist as its leader, how do I continue to live in the only place I've ever called home? To know, it is necessary to take a clear-eyed look at that place and at myself, as Didion has so many times, and to be open to what I see, whether or not it is what I hope to find. If anyone seems to understand the problem of getting through one's life without even the most basic knowledge of how, it is Didion. In the White Album, Didion wrote about her seemingly normal functioning during a period of profound personal confusion, quote, "This was an adequate enough performance as improvisations go. The only problem was that my entire education, everything I had ever been told or had told myself, insisted that the production was never meant to be improvised. I was supposed to have a script and had mislaid it. I was supposed to hear cues and no longer did," end quote. The irony here is that if Didion felt she lacked the ability in her life to improvise, that ability at the heart of jazz, her writing is absolutely jazz-like. In her sentences, phrases riff on one another. Long dependent clauses explore ideas suggested by main clauses, as the work of a jazz horn player explores chords undergirding melody. And in her investigation of topics, Didion gets to the heart of things without knowing beforehand what is there, where she is going. She goes in with her eyes open to what she will find, and she responds accordingly, like a jazz musician responding to what his bandmates are playing, acting in the moment. Now, aching over my empty nest and contemplating the world around me, it is the improvisatory skill and doggedness of the jazz musician and the clear sight of Joan Didion that I hope to bring to this book. Through travel and the one-on-one interviews recorded here, I've even tried to emulate the way Didion sets out to see for herself not what is in her own head, but what is really going on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you for those readings. I think you know how this works. Raise your hands. We'll get a mic to you. Is there somebody who would like to start us off? Well, perhaps I can prime the pump then. Both of you address your works. They're both very personal, and they're also, in a way, written to America. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if each of you, through the writing process, became closer to and more accepting of what this country is for you.
Mm. I mean, part of the impetus behind my book was to try to figure out just what, as to the degree that I could. I mean, I couldn't interview everybody or every Trump voter or every social worker or whoever. But what I was trying to do was get a possible sense of just what was behind this result of this election. And the sort of conclusions that I came to are that there are a number of things at work. I mean, I don't think that there are, you know, all of the support for this man. It's not all just like fire-breathing racists. I mean, certainly there's a lot of racism involved, but I think there are certainly other factors, and it made me, and thinking about those factors made me a little more not accepting of the result, but it makes a little more sense now, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's not any happier an outcome, but it makes a little more sense, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Saeed?
Yeah, it does make a little more sense. I mean, two factors contributed to me deciding to, at certain moments, and even in the title, the We, have a direct address. And part of it was, you know, I'm 33 now, I turned 34 in a couple of weeks. And so it means for like the last few years, until the book finally came out and people could read it and be reminded that I'm fucking brilliant. Y'all forgot. that people kept saying, like, aren't you a little young to be writing a memoir? Aren't you a little young to be writing a memoir? And I was like, how fucking old do you think Frederick Douglass was? Like, the history of memoir in American history is, like, it's a lot of young people for a lot of obvious reasons, right? And certainly there are young people surviving mass shootings now who, if they decide to write about their experiences, I'm not going to tell them they don't deserve to write a memoir. So that was on my mind a lot. But also just, you know, the circumstances, for example, that you see in the Phoenix section of the book, it just kept feeling like there were metaphors. I mean, my mom, you see in the last act of the book, she has a heart attack the night before Mother's Day. And that was both the reality, but didn't that also feel like a metaphor for something bigger, you know? I kept, you know, though I am certainly not Christian, you know, I was raised, you know, with the Bible, and I thought about the man in the Bible wrestling with the angel in the Phoenix section when I'm wrestling with Daniel, again, on this, the blue hours of a new year when Barack Obama is about to win Iowa. Like, you know, it just, as I looked at the tent poles of the book, it just seemed that they were in conversation with something bigger than it meant a lot to me, right? And so I wanted to lean into that. And then, yeah, of course, you know, I'm writing this book, and it's taking so long. And then, yeah, the election does happen. And I don't mention Trump by name in the book, but, you know, I mean, I'm writing about, you know, Matthew Shepard, and then, you know, I wake up and there was that church shooting in South Carolina, or I'm studying the Laramie Project, and there's the Pulse nightclub shooting. It just kept feeling like my writing process was already happening in conversation with contemporary America, so I wanted to at least nod to the reader that, like, I get it, like, it's hitting home in all kinds of ways, you know, so, yeah.
Clifford, can you give us a brief sketch of each of the people that you, a very brief sketch of each of the people that you interview?
Sure, sure. I interviewed a kind of a small handful of people, but kind of widely varied folks. So when I decided I wanted to do the interviews, I went on good old social media, you know, went on Facebook and said, anybody know some Trump supporters I could talk to, the kind who wouldn't kill me, you know? And so I as it happened, I had two friends in California who were able to introduce me. And so I flew out there, both the men I interviewed out there were in their 70s. One was a retired California highway patrolman. The other was a guy who had studied film and worked in advertising. And so their paths were pretty different, but some of the things they said were fairly different from each other, but
ended in the same place.
But ended in the same place, yeah. You know, so it was funny. I talked to there was a man who had served in Korea, and his daughter reached out to me through my website because. He wanted to find a black man he had served with in Korea named Clifford Thompson. And he said, you know, and so she wrote to my website and said, I'm wondering if this is probably not you, but maybe your dad. And I said, well, no, wrong both times. We stayed in touch. And so when I started doing this project, the man who had served in Korea was also one of the people I talked to, and also voted for Trump. So we had a conversation, and you know, I didn't talk to a lot of people, but I thought it might be better to have kind of in-depth conversations with a few people. So I did that. I talked to a social worker in the South Bronx, which was a pretty bracing experience after the other people I talked to, and I discovered I discovered that there was an organization called the National African American Gun Association. And I thought, what kind of an organization is this? You know, and I got very curious about it. Just the combination of words, you know, African American. I mean, you know, we've been saying African American for like a generation now. Mm-hmm. But sometimes if you think about it, it's a very interesting phrase, right. You know. African American. Think about those two things.
Every
together.
Once in a while, it's like, wait a minute.
What? Yeah,
it's kind
yeah.
of interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Now you toss guns in there, and, right. and suddenly Ooh. It's like, wow,
got a party.
What's going on? What's going on here? So I he was based in Atlanta, so I flew to Atlanta to talk to him, and he wanted to talk about guns a fair amount, but I managed to steer the conversation toward you know, toward just larger, kind of larger themes of, you know, being Black and American. And he has some interesting things to say, I thought. So, the mix to me was illuminating. Yeah.
Thank you both for sharing your work.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
So my question is for Mr. Jones.
It's been so long.
In your book, lying and keeping secrets is kind of as a theme. And there are two instances where you come clean, where it seems like it's really a moment of like clarity and relief. So when you come out to your mom and you realize you don't have to lie to her when you come out to her. And then in the end, when you admit to Esther after spending however long with her, that you're there because your mother's gone. I thought those were two beautiful moments, but I thought it was interesting after talking about lying and keeping secrets that these two powerful moments happened. Do you mind talking about that?
I mean, thank you. Thank you. That's not, I hadn't connected those two scenes in that way, and that's why, you know, hearing from readers is a real joy. I mean, I am one, you know, I think silence and the way silence metastasizes over time and what it does to us, and you keep a secret for one reason and then time goes on and now you're like all, you know, it just takes over and you can't even remember the secret you're keeping, but your life has been structured around it. That I think that happens for a lot of people and for all kinds of reasons, you know. I'm just really interested in it, you know. I was telling someone earlier today that when I was in school, for example, I would not talk about music at all. I would not talk about music at all with friends and casual. I acted as if I knew nothing about it. And even though I'm an incredibly passionate student of music, I'm obsessed with music. I listen to music as much as I read poetry. But I was afraid that if I mentioned, you know, my deep appreciation for Whitney Houston's catalog, or Brandy or Mariah Carey, that it would be outing myself in some way, right? And it took me years to realize both that's why I wasn't talking about music, and also think about the tremendous loss. Think about music is such a vital part of our, if I would like to put it back, imagine me being in school at the peak of Beyond, like Destiny's Child was happening, but imagine like me not feeling comfortable talking about someone culturally as significant as Beyonce. You know, as a high school student, think about what that closes you off from, you know. And so, yeah, that what we keep from each other, because sometimes we're right, it's not safe. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm like, listen, we can talk about why people keep secrets, and we can talk about like people are in the closet, for example, and we can talk about like you should come out of the closet. We can also talk about the fact that even now in 2019, like the Supreme Court is still deciding if it's legal to fire people for being gay or trans. We can talk about the frequency with which, you know, Black trans women are murdered. And we don't even know who they are until they become hashtags. And so like there's a relationship between the silences and the secrecy and the context in which people are living. And we are all trying to do our best. Some people are deceitful and shady, but I was just, you know, and they've got to deal with that. They do, you know. And I guess that's the other thing, is in the end, you know, we, as you see in the book, I think I thought I was protecting myself by keeping these secrets, and my mom too. I think we were like protecting each other in a way by embracing the silence, but you're suffering in real time. You know, we tell ourselves, and I think this is kind of like when you're like, you know, watching your daughters play and you're just like, it just feels like a door opens up inside your head and you're like overwhelmed, you know? But the thing is, we tell ourselves if we can avoid it, we can spare ourselves suffering. But that's not true. We're suffering now, you know, and opening that door is painful, sure, but it's the beginning. It's the beginning of change.
Hi. I am thinking about the description that your books are both personal works but kind of letters to America, and thinking of Baldwin's letter to his nephew and a grander letter. And I was wondering, and thinking of Baldwin, he tends to end on a positive note and really keep a lot of faith and a lot of hope in this country and in its people. And I was wondering, do you, after your works, did you feel that same hope or that same positivity? And do you still feel that in between, you know, when you sent it off to the publisher, when it's done, and when it actually came to print?
Well, I wanted to just address the point you made about Baldwin, you know, feeling positive. It's funny, Baldwin is kind of, Baldwin is a little bit like Malcolm X in that depending on what your point of view is, you can almost find something to justify it somewhere in Baldwin's work. Same with Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm X was probably four people over the course of, at least four people over the course of his life. Mm-hmm. And I think the same is true of Baldwin. I think, you know, you're talking about the work, The Fire Next Time, which is one of my absolute favorite books. A few years later, he wrote No Name in the Street.
I read that this summer. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. Mm-hmm. But it's a very different book. Mm. And it's I like to say it's written in the key of resignation, you know, or exhaustion, you know.
I think it was written in the key of 2019 as I was reading.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that too.
Striking.
I would characterize, I mean, you know, I Baldwin died just before I started reading his work, so I'd never met the man. But my impression is that he was able to both see things kind of for what they are and suffer that kind of embitterment while also remaining just a human being, an angry human being, but still a human being, and one who was open to people, you know. And I guess I like to think that's where I've come to, you know, I'm very angry over what's happened, but I don't think there's any choice but to go on as if there's a future, you know, and so that's what I'm going to try to do.
Yeah, I agree. There's no way forward but through. It's interesting. Prelude to Bruges has a narrative about a character named Boy, if you've read that, and it ends on a very ambivalent note. When the last few lines of the book are like, I am not your boy, I am not your boy, I am not. And I did that because I find that when people are repeating themselves in a declarative sentence, there's usually a lot of ambivalence. They're trying to convince themselves, I'm not your boy, I'm not, you know, you're like, are you sure? You know, like, you really, you know, like, are you, you're saying something, and that's such an important thing for him to say because he's been this object the whole time, and then he's finally taking ownership, but it seems a little on the edge, you know, and to me, I like that because it's like, you've seen the deception and, you know, the silence is all these major themes in my work, and then you get to the end, and it's the beginning of the revelation, and you close the book, and I think that's the moment where I hope the reader goes, oh, I need to do this work. You know, that's what I think the book, your feeling at the end of a book should be. Not like, oh, that was nice, but like, oh, now my project begins. Mm-hmm. And so I like that, and How We Fight for Our Lives is like that as well. You know, I wanted to show, certainly the initial weeks, the grief, my mother dying, being in the hospital, burying her, and the days after, and what that is like, in part because when my mom died, I was trying to find books about grief. And there were very few well-written books about grief by men that weren't like grief might be in them, but they would be like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or alcohol, and grief would be tucked in. The very few books I found that were just straight on about grief, like Wild, Cheryl Strayed, The Long Goodbye by Megan O'Rourke, they were by women. You know, and so I wanted to do that, and then to show, you know, months out, because that's a really bizarre aspect of grief. You know, when the funeral's over and all the flowers that people have sent you have died, if you're like me, and you've got to figure it out. So I wanted to end the book not necessarily on hope, because the fight never ends, and I didn't want people to be under illusions that like, oh, Syed has it all figured out. I wanted you to see one of the moments in my life where I realized there's no way forward but through. And I'm not thrilled. I mean, right? It's like a nice ending and comforting in some ways, but it's also very like, I don't know, I guess I'll give it another shot, is kind of how I felt. And that's important to me because isn't that how we feel most days, honestly? Like, all right, here we go. You know, and I think we should honor that because I'm not stopping. You know, I'm not bright-eyed, but like, ooh, this is so great. But I'm like, but I'm going to do the work. And that's what it is to create art. That is what it is to continue to strive for kindness when I know we are so exhausted, you know? And so, yeah, it's not about hope, but about the fact that even when Baldwin, the color changes from that first book to No Name in the Street, he's still very determined. And I think that's important.
If I can just add a note, one other thing I keep coming back to in the book is that it's very difficult to get through life without some sort of what I call rootedness in the book, some sort of some belonging to, you know, maybe it's an idea, maybe it's a community, but it's something, and it seems to be kind of necessary for just to sort of get through the day. And whatever it is, whatever it is that you hold on to, you know, maybe it's a religion, or maybe it's a group of people, a set of beliefs, or whatever it is. And sometimes, the danger of, sometimes if you take a look at things as they are, and it may contrast with that set of beliefs that you hold. And what do you do then? You know, as I say, it's very hard to get through life without that set of beliefs. So sometimes you kind of you hold on to those beliefs anyway, as a kind of a leap of faith, an act of faith, I think at the end of my book I have sort of a foot in each camp, you know, but I'm trying to go forward.
Yeah. So. Oh, and then you asked a kind of meta question about the publishing of the book, which is different, right? Like Saeed and Cliff on the page is different than who we are in front of you. Mm. So one, part of the power of the book as I see it is that I live a public life. And so people know, like, things are great. Like I'm very grateful, and I feel gilded often with joy. And so I think seeing the struggle of the book, I knew that when I finished it, it would be powerful to hear what I had made it through and see me, laughing and, having a good time looking at my past clear-eyed. And I knew that those two dynamics were in conversation with one another. And I guess if not hope, I mean, when I finished the damn book, oh my gosh, and it took so much longer. I mean, memoir, it takes so much more of you than you think. You know, you have intentions, but it just, because it's not just a book, it's a book that's a product of your memory. So there's this self-interrogation that is on top of just the writing. It's a lot. But when I finished it, I was so proud that before anyone else read it, I knew I had written the book that I wanted to read. Mm. I'm very much a student of Morrison in that way. Mm. And I felt that. I knew that I had, that paragraph with, like, the golden boy. You know, I sent it to my editor. I was like, you cut that paragraph. I'm going to come to your office. I wish you would. You know, and then he was like, I wasn't even, don't worry, Saeed. I was nervous about the tree. I was like, we're keeping the orange tree. You know, I was just like, so determined, you know. And so I was just thrilled with a major publisher, you know, all these eyes on me, all this institutional support. And the book I wrote is the book I've always wanted to read. And you can't fake that feeling. And so that was the hope that for all of this, you know, that's a tremendous accomplishment.
Here's to finishing books. Please join me in thanking Saeed Jones and Clifford Thompson.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.